Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week, and hope that there's some variety there, something that will interest almost everyone. If you're interested, by the way, in hearing some programs that you might have missed, there may be even some you might want to listen to again, you can sign up for our podcast. Just go to our website. That's will.illinois.edu, and it will tell you everything that you need to know. Abraham Lincoln is widely regarded as our greatest president, yet he is not universally revered. In fact, there are places in this country where the very idea of a statue of Lincoln in the town square would be unthinkable. The question we take up this morning is, how is it that a single historical figure could inspire such widely divergent views? Our guest for the program is Andrew Ferguson, and we'll be talking about his book, Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. It is a part travelogue, part history. It's a look at the many ways that Lincoln's spirit and mythology and philosophy continue to shape our national identity. It's published in paperback by the Grove Press. I'm certain that you can find it in the bookstore. Our guest, Andrew Ferguson, is senior editor at the Weekly Standard magazine. He's also written for The New Yorker, The New Republic, The Washington Post, Fortune, Time, and many other publications. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving along. But anyone who's interested is welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Ferguson, hello.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, I appreciate you talking with us. And after all, it's the land of Lincoln. This is Illinois. This is the land of Lincoln.
So. Believe me, I know. I was born there myself.
Well, and it's interesting. I grew up in the Chicago area and resonated with a lot of this. Certainly when I was a kid, I was taken to the Springfield, and we did the tomb and the house. And I also, and I hadn't thought about it in such a long time, also when I was a kid, I was taken to the Chicago Historical Society. And I think, like you, I remember being fascinated with the dioramas, the little rooms with the scenes inside. I just thought that was there was something really, really compelling about that. So, yeah, I can definitely connect with the child, you know, being on the Lincoln Trail as a kid.
Yeah, I think a lot of us from Illinois can, of course. And the interesting thing, though, is how it's not just us. You know, we live or grow up in the land of Lincoln, but one of the ironies, I guess, of the title of the book is that the land of Lincoln isn't just Illinois, it's the whole country.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's, you know, it's interesting that we should feel that Americans should feel this kind of ownership of this man, and that goes beyond the way I think probably people feel about any other American president. I don't know that people particularly feel that way about George Washington or Jefferson or Jackson or either the Roosevelts or Ronald Reagan or anybody. I'm not sure that there is any other figure that has that kind of standing. And again, it's not to say that there aren't people who, you know, would have something bad to say about Lincoln, because
well,
there are.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, the thing that, you know, I agree with you completely. I mean, he seems to take up more real estate in our national imagination than just about anybody else. But the thing, as you point out, that really started me on the book was I live here in Washington, D.C. now, and I picked up the newspaper one morning and a couple of years ago, and there was a headline that said, Lincoln statue stirs outrage in Richmond, and meaning Richmond, Virginia, which, of course, is the old capital of the Confederacy. And I just thought, you know, you see this word Lincoln and outrage in the same sentence. They're not supposed to go together, you know. So I read on, and sure enough, it turned out that the city fathers down in Richmond, with the help of the National Park Service, were going to install a statue of Lincoln right there down by the river in their beautiful little city. And to commemorate Lincoln's visit, Lincoln went there right after the war was over, about 6 days before he was killed, went there with his son and walked around newly liberated Richmond. But it turned out when they announced that they were going to put this statue in, it just set off a firestorm. I mean, there were demonstrations in the streets, there were ads in the newspaper, there were work stoppages, And it, you know, I just thought, well, this is something I have to check out, because it was so far beyond my imagination of what Lincoln could inspire in people.
Mm-hmm. You'd have to wonder what it was, and particularly because it's been a while. You know, a little time has passed, you know, that people would still have that kind of intensity of feeling about Lincoln. Now, so long after the fact, you know, it's been a long time since he strolled through the streets of Richmond.
Right, absolutely. Well, yeah, like 140 years. And but, you know, there is something about Lincoln that gets under our skin, either negatively, as it happened in Richmond, or positively, that we develop a kind of intimate relationship with him in a way, as you point out, that we don't with George Washington or FDR or, you know, more recently Reagan or someone like that. And I wanted to find out, why is that? You know, what is it about Lincoln in particular? And so I went down to Richmond and I hung around with a lot of these guys. Some of them were from the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and you know, I was sort of expecting a bunch of crackers, to be honest. You know, guys chewing on straw and smoking Burl Reds and everything. But they held a scholarly conference in a hotel downtown there in Richmond, and you know, they were just normal guys. You know, they could have been airlifted off any community golf course in America. They just were just hanging out one weekend, hating Abraham Lincoln. So the thing that was most unnerving to me about that, though, was. They knew more about Lincoln than I did. And here I was, you know, sort of a Lincoln buff growing up on Lincoln Street and in the land of Lincoln and so on. And these guys had really read deeply, if not widely, in the literature of Lincoln and the Civil War, and they couldn't stand him. And I have to tell you that it was sort of disconcerting to me, as someone who's always grown up with a very great fondness for Lincoln, to find out that these guys who hated him actually knew more about Lincoln than I did.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is that as part of this whole business, the people that put together this conference also brought in some historians, some professional academics, in a sense to be the Lincoln defenders. And what seems to be the case is that if you look at both of these camps and the depths of their feelings and the way that they express themselves, it almost seemed as if the Lincoln haters were more directly had a more kind of an intimate relationship and connection with him than did the Lincoln scholars that were presumably there to defend his image.
Yeah. No, they felt him more powerfully. And that was the other disconcerting thing, is that what had happened was that after these Lincoln haters put on their big conference about, you know, trying to debunk Lincoln, the people who were putting on the statues had a scholarly conference of their own, and they brought in these guys. And I went there fully expecting to kind of get the full rebuttal of all these scholars that I'd seen in the anti-Lincoln thing. But these guys were terrible. I mean, they were like trying to make Lincoln into Bill Moyers or something. You know, it was sort of what one guy praised him, Lincoln, for his vulnerability. Another one said how non-judgmental Lincoln was. And, you know, I mean, I may not have known a lot about Lincoln, but one thing I knew is the guy waged the most savage war in our history up to that point, and non-judgmentalism did not strike me as being his main feature. But they sort of wanted to turn him into an image of themselves, really, of what they wanted him to be. And so they had kind of developed this image of this sort of new agey, soft-spoken, gentle guy. And I just thought, wait a minute, this can't be right. And so that sort of set me off on the book. I thought, well, what is it about Lincoln then? What is it? You know, why aren't we defending him in the ways that we should? Why do we try and turn him into just an image of ourselves rather than deal with the man who he really was?
And it seems to me that's a central kind of a theme that you deal with in the book. That is, and that might go some ways to explaining to answering the question, why is it that he seems to be so much a part of American culture? That is, there is something about him, and it may in fact have something to do with that we don't really know him as well as we should. Something about him that lends it, something about his character that lends itself to being made one thing or another. That is, you know, whatever Lincoln you want, you can have.
Right. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that he is still, despite what they said in Richmond, still so revered that everybody wants to claim a piece of him. The other fact is that you know, there are a lot of things about a man who's been dead 140 years we can't know. And so into these sort of empty spaces of our knowledge about him, we sort of pour our own hopes and aspirations. You know, I say in the book that, you know, for generations we told ourselves we wanted our children to grow up to be like Lincoln, and, you know, steadfast and resolute and kind and principled and so on. But what we've really wanted is for Lincoln to be like us. When I started to go into this and looked at all the, you know, contemporary books that have come out about Lincoln, I mean, you know, there's just an avalanche of them year after year after year, and they still sell pretty well, which is why they keep getting published. But one thing I noticed about them was that they were all sort of fractured or fragments of Lincoln. You know, in the last few years there was one, a Lincoln book, saying that Lincoln was a fundamentalist Christian. Well, that I looked into it, and that was written by a fundamentalist Christian. You know, there was another one that proved that Lincoln was, his greatness lay in his struggle with depression. Well, that's a book written by a journalist who's also struggled with depression. I guess most famous of all, there was the book in 2005 that aimed to prove that Lincoln was an active homosexual, which was written by a homosexual activist. I mean, there was even a book a couple of years ago arguing that if Lincoln were alive today, his political beliefs would be essentially the same as Mario Cuomo's, and I don't need to tell you who wrote that book. But it just seemed as though Lincoln had been sort of torn apart or fragmented, and this huge Lincoln that I had grown up thinking about, this figure that kind of hovered over the whole country, this part of our national patrimony, had been broken apart and kind of privatized. And I was hoping that I might be able to find, you know, the Lincoln, not the manic depressive, not the gay, not the fundamentalist Christian Lincoln, but the real Lincoln.
Yeah. Something else that strikes me is that when you think about important American leaders and points of American history, it seems that it's very difficult for us now to relate to early America. And you can't quite imagine sitting down and having coffee with George Washington.
Yeah.
But that once you start maybe to get into the 1800s, and particularly into the mid-1800s, somehow these people, they start to look a little bit more like us, mm-hmm. and to feel a little bit more like us. And I think it actually is, you actually can imagine sitting down and having coffee and talking to Abraham Lincoln in a way that you just can't. Ben Franklin,
yeah, yeah.
Maybe. Ben Franklin, him, you could go out and knock back a couple of beers with Ben Franklin, but not George Washington. And somehow it seems that even though, you know, these people are several generations removed from us, it seems a little bit more like, they seem a little bit more like us.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of interesting speculation about why that is. I mean, one thing about Lincoln, of course, is that he was a very humorous guy. He loved to tell stories, and the people who were around him loved to be around him, and so that's a sort of a welcoming aspect of his image. The other thing that's just undeniable is that Lincoln was really the first generation of Americans to be photographed, and in fact, Lincoln never passed up a chance to have his photograph made. In fact, by the time he died, he was easily the most photographed man in America, and had the most famous image of any man up until that time. And that kind of, you know, looking at a photograph rather than, you know, a Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington, photographs are warmer and more inviting and more immediate. And so when we look at all these magnificent portraits, photographic portraits that were made of Lincoln, they kind of invite us in a way that the old oil paintings couldn't.
Yeah. Our guest is Andrew Ferguson. He's a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. It's written for many other publications, including The New Yorker and The New Republic and The Washington Post. And he is the author of the book Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America, which is part history and part travelogue. It's in part the product of his traveling around the country and going to various places that mark Lincoln, talking to people about them, getting at some sense about how it is that as a nation and as individuals, we think about Abraham Lincoln. The Grove Press is the publisher of the book. It's in paper, and it's a good read. So you can go out and look at the book, and here we'd welcome people to join the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have some callers, and we'll start with someone here in Urbana.
Hello? Yes, good morning.
Yes.
A couple comments. First, Lincoln's self-education. in his anti-slavery views, and maybe you can comment on both those. You know, having received almost no formal education, you know, he did embark on this quest of learning and self-improvement. And I remember reading a humorous anecdote about him when he had a single term in the House of Representatives. You know, his colleagues considered humorous that he used to spend his spare time poring over books in the Library of Congress. And, you know, he just didn't have access to the institutional learning that maybe a lot of the other folks did. Another thing, too, is, you know, he had expressed anti-slavery views, I think, between 1854 and 1860, particularly with the, you know, right after the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And, you know, that opened up the heartland, the Trans-Mississippi West. And I just always wonder if, you know, a lot of people question his anti-slavery views as being political, but there's a lot of evidence that his anti-slavery views were much more than political, but they were really deeply moral, and I was just wondering what your comment might be on that.
Well, those are two excellent points. On the matter of his education, I think that's one of the things that's always inspired people so much about Lincoln is he does have this element of the self-made man, which is a model that we revere here in the United States. And Lincoln's story of a guy who really was almost denied education. He said, and historians have tried to calculate this, he probably had about 18 months of formal schooling in his entire life. But he did things, like even as an adult, he went through the books of Pythagoras to try and teach himself geometry. I mean Euclid, and to teach himself Euclidean geometry, and would sit down with huge books in a dictionary and just look up words one after another. And this is not just as a boy and as a young man, but as an older and accomplished lawyer that he did this. He never lost that thirst for trying to learn more, and it was bound up with his own personal ambition, of course. It also reminds us of how rustic his background really was. You know, when you read about what life was like there in central Illinois, and of course before that in southern Indiana, where he was raised, and Kentucky, where he was born, you're really looking at life that's, you know, a couple of rungs up the ladder from the Bronze Age. I mean, this is really, really primitive life. And a book was a extremely valuable commodity, and there was sort of a natural reverence for books that I suppose nowadays we don't quite have. As far as his anti-slavery views, this is a subject that historians, believe me, I got so caught up in this, and there's some about it in the book that historians have been wrangling about, you know, pretty much since that night at Ford's Theater. The earliest real expression that we have of Lincoln's views on slavery came in the 1830s when he was a state legislator, and he and another colleague wrote a dissent from a bill that was in the legislature supporting slavery in the District of Columbia. And he points out that although he wasn't an abolitionist, he didn't favor the abolition of slavery. Slavery was clearly an inhuman institution, but it was something that would have to be resolved through constitutional means. That was a statement put out in about 1837. All the way to 1861, Lincoln was still pointing at that thing that he had written as a man of, what, 28 or 29, and saying, this still expresses my views about slavery. It is clearly an offense against God and against the moral order, but it is something that has to be resolved under the constitutional order, or else we will threaten the constitutional order itself. And it's a kind of a complicated view because I think most people want to hope that he would have been an abolitionist or a racial liberal in our own terms. But he wasn't that way. He was a man of his own time, but he was still quite a progressive man.
Is the caller there? Does it get at your
question? Thanks a lot.
All right, let's go on to someone in Springfield here, line number two. Hello.
Oh, howdy, fellas. How are you doing today?
Good.
Hi.
Oh, I grew up in Texas most of my life, and oddly enough, I got a job as an actor at the Lincoln Museum in Springfield for the past 3 years. And frankly, down in Texas, down in the deep south where Texas was pretty much bankrupted during the Civil War and people were had really hard times, it was basically a racist view that colored the view of Lincoln down there. And, of course, I was a person who had to be immersed in that. But now that I've worked at the Lincoln Museum as an actor for going on 3 years, and I have become really, really fond of him, extremely fond of him, because of his the wonderful writing that he did, Mm-hmm. And the a quote comes to mind. Well, not a quote. Well, it's when he arrived at some point to greet some Southern troops. He said, "Let's play Dixie, because these are our brothers and our friends." And also concerning his views on slavery, he also I keep hearing these quotes over and over as I pass through the museum, that if someone favors slavery, he would like to see it personally tried on them. That would be I think he was a pretty wonderful person, actually.
Right. Well, the personal qualities of him are so clear. I mean, and they still show through throughout, you know, the 140 years since he's been dead. One of the things that's also, we had talked about how immediate Lincoln seems to us and how people develop this sort of personal affection for him. One of the reasons for that is partly because of a great Springfieldian named William Herndon, who was one of Lincoln's law partners, his last law partner for the last 15 years of his life, and a close and intimate friend, as intimate as anybody could be with Lincoln, I think, who immediately after Lincoln's martyrdom, as he referred to it, set out on one of the greatest reporting and historical projects any American has undertaken. He went out and tried to find everyone he could who had known Lincoln as a boy and as a young man, and recorded their memories of him. So we have now today, they're in the Herndon papers are in the Library of Congress, thousands of pages of handwritten notes of interviews that Herndon conducted with people who were close to Lincoln as he grew up. And I'd say a good 80% of what we know about Lincoln before he moved to Springfield comes from Herndon, because he had the foresight and the will to embark on this great project. So this gave us all these wonderful stories that make Lincoln come alive for us in a way that wouldn't have been possible without Herndon.
Oh, well, thanks very much
for being
on the show.
Thanks for the call. I wonder, too, though, whether part of this phenomenon of the many Lincolns does have to do with the fact that, well, he certainly left behind a lot of writing. We have no Lincoln presidential memoir. He never got the chance to write that book the way that others have. And so what we have is an awful lot have been written about him by other people that may well indeed have some kind of agenda. And that was something that began almost, I think, almost immediately after he died. So people have been doing that all these many years.
Right. Lincoln wrote a couple of very brief biographies for campaign purposes that could be printed up and distributed, but they're really not particularly revealing documents, as you would expect. One of the things that happened, and I think this, as much as I admire what Herndon did and certainly that treasure trove of papers that he acquired, there was a kind of self-censorship that entered in after Lincoln's death. He was so immediately sort of elevated into this kind of pantheon and almost looked on as a supernatural figure by so many Americans that anyone who had reservations about his personality or his character simply would shut up. You know, it was not to your advantage if you were going to be quoted saying something negative about the great martyr who had just died. So as a consequence of that, there is a certain tilt in the reminiscences that we have among his friends. And there were people who really never spoke about him at all, who we know were both legal and political adversaries of his, and it would be very interesting to know what their views of Lincoln were. I have an example in the book that's quite sort of provocative, which is Lincoln loved, as we know, to tell stories. What is less well known is that Lincoln loved to tell dirty stories. He had a real weakness for, you know, this is sort of like, I'd say, something that could be on HBO after 11 o'clock, maybe not on Midnight Blue or something, but still pretty coarse stuff. And the only instances we have of these jokes, these sort of off-color jokes that he had, were put down in private letters among Lincoln's friends writing back and forth long after he was dead, and a couple of them have been recorded, and I put them down in the book, and I think people would be surprised at exactly how salacious a couple of them are, really. But again, this is something that simply people would not talk about in the first even century after his death.
Other callers here are certainly welcome, and we'll go next and talk with someone in Tuscola. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Another interesting show. Wonderful topic. Couple of quick observations and a question for your guest, and I'll take the answer offline. I was struck by what David was saying, the feeling of being able to relate to Lincoln, and I agree with that. Washington's time, it seems, by comparison, prehistoric. What I was struck by was a visit to the Lincoln Library and going through everything and looking at the people who were involved in his assassination, and I don't have the gentleman's name in front of me, but someone got away, escaped, whatever, went to South America, came back. Anyway, the guy lived to 1911, and I'm looking at this, and I was like, well, geez, 1911, my dad was born in 1911, and that seems far away, but not altogether that far away. And I do think that, traveling the towns of Illinois, we're all trying to get a piece of Lincoln. Lincoln stayed here. Lincoln spoke here. Walking down Washington Street in Chicago, a nondescript building, there's a little plaque that Washington's widow lived here. It was a hotel right after his death. And so I do think we're all trying to grab a little piece of Lincoln for our own selves. But my question is, I'm old enough to remember the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and they came out with these comparisons between JFK and Lincoln and all these things that seemed to fit together. In a revisionist thinking now on JFK was, he was far from perfect. But I was wondering, do you think the assassination of Lincoln was necessary to get him to the point where he is now? In other words, if he would have played out his term and lived to be an old man, would he have been a good president? But he certainly wouldn't have been anything near what we consider today about him. And I'm going to listen off air. Thanks.
Well, that's a great question that I've thought a lot about, and I think a lot of historians and Lincoln buffs have thought about. And my answer is, what Lincoln accomplished through his life, and in especially the last 4 and 5 years of his life, was of such importance and of such is so essential to the country that we have today that we would revere him regardless. It's true that he was killed on the evening of Good Friday, and by Sunday morning, hundreds of preachers throughout America were comparing Easter morning were comparing the martyr of Ford's Theater to Jesus, and it didn't. There were a lot of people who didn't think that was a stretch, and it immediately had this kind of slingshot effect and catapulted him into this almost pseudo divinity where he stayed. That wouldn't have happened, obviously, if he hadn't been assassinated, and we don't know how he could have conducted his administration through the terrible political difficulties of the post-war period. Certainly he would have been better than his successor, Andrew Johnson, but we don't know how he would have done that. But I still think that looking at what he did in not just preserving the Union, which is, of course, what he's known for, but in preserving a certain kind of union, a union that was, as he said, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That is an achievement that makes Lincoln, all by itself, one of the great men in human history, I think. And whether he was assassinated or not, that could never have been taken away from him.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Andrew Ferguson. He's a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. He's written for New Yorker, New Republic, Washington Post, Fortune Time, other national publications, and he is the author of the book, The Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. It is something of a history, something of a biography, something of a travelogue, all of those three things put together, the result of his traveling around the country, thinking about Lincoln, talking to people about their Images and Thoughts and Impressions of Abraham Lincoln. The book is now in paper, and it's published by Grove Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're just a little bit past our midpoint here, and we'll go on and talk to next with someone in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. From another direction entirely, not the sort of irredentist Confederates, but I wonder if you spent any time surveying Lerone Bennett Jr.'s thesis that his book is Forced into Glory. I bring this up every now and again. It's a bestseller in the African-American community in the U.S., but very little commented upon by others. And I attended a debate on Lincoln's birthday with the Lincoln scholars and Lerone Bennett at the old State Capitol building, where he actually... And it was amazing to see what transpired. I was very persuaded. The thesis itself is that basically stated in Forced into Glory that far from being a champion of ideals, he was what Lerone called a trimmer, basically. I don't expect to be sympathetic, but I'm wondering how you handled and countered that kind of argument.
Well, I actually spent a day with Lerone Bennett in researching the book. Unfortunately, he didn't make the cut. I had this chapter about the sons of Confederate veterans and their contempt for Lincoln and the reasons for it in there. And the odd thing is, as even Bennett will acknowledge once in a while, his arguments and theirs really overlap quite a bit, and in fact, they're kind of using the same logic, and I would say the same sort of historical sleight of hand in the putting together the Lincoln that they present and that they revile.
Could you illustrate that substantively, as opposed to just, you know?
I'm sorry?
How illustrate that substantively, as opposed to?
Well, okay, a good example is you talk about Lincoln being a trimmer. Or Bennett does, and there's no, that's certainly a word for what Lincoln did. Another word for it is that he was a politician, and a politician working within the confines of democratic politics in which nothing can be done without consensus, that's what separates us from a tyranny, is simply the way you have to do business. Now, you can look at it from one angle and say he was a trimmer. You can look at it another way from saying he was a political realist. He points out, for example, that Lincoln wasn't an abolitionist, as I think he wishes Lincoln was, and certainly as many people do. Lincoln opposed abolition for democratic reasons. He said that if the government simply, through extra-constitutional means, wiped away slavery, confiscated all the slaves and freed them, with compensation or not to the slaveholders, you would have had a violation of the very form of government that was going to be, in the long run, the only guarantee of the rights of black Americans. And in violating that constitutional order, you were going to open up a kind of mob rule or a tyrannical principle that would rival slavery itself. And this is the heart of Lincoln's argument and the explanation for why he was, as Lerone says, a trimmer. He wanted to preserve, above all, the constitutional order that in the long run would be the surest guarantee of equal rights.
Well, it's doing justice to his, to the argument is difficult on a talk show, but... what I struck, maybe I should just give an anecdote then. What struck me as really interesting was Mr. Bennett produced a document at the Lincoln Scholars debate that showed that Lincoln kept funded something called a Negro Removal Office that the radical Republicans, as they were called at the time, who had control of the Congress, refused to authorize. That this was something that Lerone, found atrocious. That that he was speaking of it in really scathing terms, and Bennett actually got red baited, which is a curious phenomena at this this debate. The reason that's important, it seems to me, is that far from even having a mild sort of understanding of well, I'm suffering from a little fatigue here and a bit of a
I understand and sympathize exactly with what you're saying, and part of the problem here, and I think this is one of the reasons that Bennett has had the success that he has in spreading his view of Lincoln, is that the mythological Lincoln that a lot of people were taught up through the 50s and 60s never grappled with either the subtlety of Lincoln's views on slavery or his very problematic views about race itself. You know, there is no question that by our lights today, Lincoln was a racist. That's just true. There is a long paper trail to make that clear. Within the context of his times, he was a progressive or a liberal on racial matters. And this is clear throughout the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Stephen Douglas race-baited Lincoln continually. Lincoln rose to the bait on one or two occasions, but throughout it, you know, for example, Douglas would say, you're for equal rights with black people, Mr. Lincoln, therefore you must approve of, you must want to have white men and black women marry. Well, of course, that would have been the most outrageous thing anyone could have said. Lincoln's response was, just because I'm for equal rights doesn't mean that I want to take a black woman for my wife. I can just let her alone. And for that time, that was an extremely radical statement, to think that black people could just be left alone to earn their own money, to vote the way they wanted, to do all of the things that were given to them under the natural rights of the Constitution. So he may not be a racial liberal as we would have liked, or as Lerone Bennett would have liked, but in the lights of his own time, he was the most effective advocate of black rights that there was.
I need to jump in. We just have 10 minutes left and get some other callers here, and I'd like to give some other folks a chance and mention again the phone number, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Andrew Ferguson. He's senior editor at the Weekly Standard Magazine, and his book is Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. Next, we'll talk with someone in Chicago. This is Line 2. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Three questions. One, how did Abraham Lincoln feel about the Dred Scott decision? Two, how did he feel about the activities of John Brown? And finally, how much would history have been changed if he had married Mary Rutledge?
He wrote and spoke incessantly for two or three years about the Dred Scott decision, the great House Divided speech that he gave down there in Springfield is sort of almost a legal brief about the Dred Scott decision and what the consequences of that decision would be. He was appalled by it and saw it as a tremendous usurpation of legislative power by the judicial branch, and thought it was abhorrent, and also thought, I think rightly, that it was inevitable that civil war would result from it. There's less evidence on what exactly he thought about John Brown. He clearly wasn't an abolitionist, so he wouldn't have sympathized with Brown in that respect. And I think he was. And there are some on the record statements that he abhorred Brown's tactics and thought that it was perfectly appropriate that he was hanged for what he did. As far as it's Anne Rutledge that that the great legend is about, and I think it's unclear yet. Even and historians fashions have gone back and forth on this about whether there actually was a romance between Lincoln and Anne Rutledge. I've sat with historians for hours and trying to convince me of one truth or another about it. If he had married Ann Rutledge, he wouldn't have married Mary Lincoln. If he hadn't married Mary Lincoln, he might not have had this tremendous goad to his own ambition, which is what Mary Lincoln was.
Yeah, I wanted him to be president. Myself that if he had married Ann Rutledge, and I apologize for getting him, he would not have been president because she didn't have the same drive that
right.
Mary Todd had.
Right, that's an excellent point, and I agree with it completely.
Okay, thank you.
All right, then we'll go to Belgium, the community not that far from here. Line number three, hello.
Hello. I would like to point out that that Lincoln spent a lot of time here with Herndon in his law practice, and after all, what he was a railroad lawyer.
Yes, yes, he definitely did work for the railroads. He was a very he had a very lucrative law practice. In fact, one of the his greatest case or most lucrative case earned him in Chicago $5,000, which I can't even begin to imagine what that would be today. It's very hard to translate dollars from then to now because of buying power and so on. But it was a huge amount of money. But he wasn't simply a railroad lawyer. This is a sort of a disparaging term that people like to apply to him in a sort of a debunking or revisionist sort of way. He worked for the railroads, but he worked for lots and lots and lots of people. He handled divorces and estate cases and boundary disputes and, you know, patent law. He did just about everything that a prairie lawyer could do in those days, and certainly the railroads liked to hire him because he was a pretty good lawyer.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. There's a lot of really interesting material here in the book. I guess one thing I'd like to at least try to talk a little bit about here in the time that's left is people's enthusiasm for Lincoln memorabilia. And partly that's just anything that maybe would have Lincoln's image, but particularly things that had a connection to him. If you could demonstrate that some object, he had actually touched it or used it, that would make it very valuable. What's really remarkable here is that apparently there are people who are even willing to pay money for fakes, known fakes of Lincoln stuff.
Yeah. What's happened is, you know, especially in the 80s, real good Lincoln stuff just got priced out of the range of anybody except for very wealthy people. And that has to do with real Lincoln letters, you know, certainly items of clothing, books that he owned, so on. And so what happened is, as happens with markets, the definition of really good Lincoln stuff started to expand. And so now that Lincoln signatures were out of the reach of a lot of people going for $5,000, $7,000, there started to be a trade in especially two extremely good Lincoln forgers who worked in the 20s and 30s and who revered for the artistic quality of their forgeries. And so one guy's named Cozy, another guy's named Weisberg. I was talking to one of these dealers, and I just couldn't believe this. He was telling me people were spending a couple of $1,000s for what they knew was a forged signature by Cozy or Weisberg. And I said, you know, I can't, that just is a little too odd for me. And the guy said, quite seriously, he said, well, yeah, you know, you got to be careful because there's a lot of fakes out there.
Oh, if there's one thing I hate, it's a fake fake.
Yeah, fake. That's just going too far.
I have to say, I'm sort of embarrassed to say that as close as it is, I still have not yet visited the new Lincoln Museum in Springfield. You've been there. What was your impressions of the place?
Well, I have a chapter, in fact, about it on how it got built and the kind of thinking that went into it. I was, I should preface it by saying that the thing has been a success. It's done what the city fathers there wanted it to do. I have reservations as a Lincoln buff and as somebody who really, you know, sort of wants to propagandize history and wants people to learn more about history. I think that there's something almost kind of dumbed down about the approach that they took. You know, they hired a former Disney employee who had specialized in doing things like Pirates of the Caribbean and so on, the rides in Disneyland. And there is that kind of atmosphere of you know, just sort of pure entertainment and fun in the museum. There are very few, especially for somebody just kind of walking through, there's not many facts, there's not a lot of talk about serious questions of historical controversy, you never quite get an idea of why Lincoln was great. In the end, you kind of get this sense of Lincoln's important because people have thought he was really important. And, you know, it's kind of like that definition, he's famous for being famous. And I think that they missed a real opportunity to educate people about why Lincoln has lasted so long and why he's so important to so many Americans. Well, on the other hand, you know, a lot of people have now been exposed to Lincoln that might not have been otherwise, and so you really have to weigh whatever reservations I have, you have to weigh it against that.
Yeah, well, clearly what the people in Springfield wanted to do was create something that would draw tourists, so people would come to Springfield and they would spend money. It seemed that coupled to that, though, was this idea that there would be this research institution that would be the equivalent of the kind of presidential library that we have now. Is it actually possible to do both of those things? Have they accomplished both of those things?
Well, we're going to have to wait and see. People I know who have used the library and gone through the papers there have nothing but wonderful things to say, especially compared. You know, it used to be down in an old converted parking garage beneath the old state capitol building. And, you know, people said you go in there, there was mold everywhere, there were leaves piled up in the corner. It was just appalling that the state of Illinois had treated its historical patrimony in this way. And, in fact, that was the first impetus to doing the museum at all, was they needed a new place to house their marvelous collection of documents and relics. And that has been done. That could have been done for about $10 million, you know, instead... You've got $150 million plus having been spent on this, you know, sort of extremely extravagant museum.
Yeah. One more caller at least here. We have someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Yes, a couple of comments, more than a question, but briefly as I can. One thing always struck me, my daughter more gravitates toward large cities and the big bright lights and all that. I thought, you know, if you live in Terre Haute and this part of the Midwest, and you can't, you've got what you don't have, but look around at what you do have. And it always struck me that our proximity to the Lincoln sites was something that is unique about living in this area. So, you know, we took the trip down to Kentucky to see the birthplace, in Indiana to see the childhood home, and then cross to Vincennes, and then up into Springfield. Been there several times in New Salem. It's just such a great resource for folks living in this area. The second thing is, I'm kind of amused by your comment about people getting the Lincoln that they want. I think, you know, we do that to Jesus all the time. You go to half a dozen different churches, you're going to get half a dozen different Jesuses, so it's at least appropriate that we get at least that many Lincolns out of the deal, because we all read into what we want to, what we really want to see, what we want to hear, and that's the nature of history. I think when you read old history books, as they read into the facts, their understanding, and now we read into the facts, our understanding. And it's like the fellows with the elephant. Everybody gets a part of it. No one gets the whole thing. So I think it's best to be expected. The last thing is, my kin are from South Carolina, from the other side of the Civil War. And I was doing some genealogy work up in Fairfield County in South Carolina. And it was a historical society there, and somebody would come in, and they realized this thing on the wall was Wade Hampton, a Civil War South Carolina hero, general. It was his farewell address to the troops, and they got to talking about it, and I realized just by overhearing this conversation that, you know, we've never been occupied in Indiana or anywhere in the North. We were never invaded, and we were never occupied. Any, of course, debate about invasion and who caused all that, but still, the armies that went through that part of the country after the march to Atlanta, then swinging north through Savannah and up to Charleston, and South Carolina being the home of secession, those folks have living memory to this very day of the war. And they're not talking about Vietnam. You know, they are talking about the Civil War. At least this is 20 years ago when I was down there. I'm assuming it's the same. And, you know, Lincoln, I think, to some folks, your reference to the conference that was being put on, you know, Lincoln is the great symbol of that war. And without his persistence and without his dogged determination, and certainly the outcome could have been quite, quite different. So I think it's good for us up north to realize that the impact of the war is felt in a different way, And that's part of that Southern culture. And for better or for worse, along with grits and biscuits and gravy and all that, they have this living experience from their kin, and they celebrate that. And it is true. You don't see anything in my travels about slavery and those sorts of you see very little recognition of the economic basis of that life, and you see very little about anyone except the great cause. So I just wanted to make a few comments, and enjoyed your presentation.
Well, I appreciate the comment, and I don't know, Mr. Ferguson, maybe I can give you about 45 seconds.
Well, I agree with everything he said. Those are very good comments. You know, I should say, especially about Central Illinois and Southern Indiana and Northern Kentucky, those places are magical, partly because of the Lincoln story and that it was touched by this greatness, not just Lincoln himself, but that whole time. And I hope that people who live there do realize how marvelous it is, a resource that they can take part in, because it adds magic to where you live. And it's the thing that certainly added magic to me growing up in Illinois, and I would hate for that to be lost. I think that it's a very intimate and public thing all at once to see that the place that you live is been made great by history.
And as an adult, if you go back to one of those places, like, you know, as a grown-up, if you go back to New Salem, does it have the same kind of, does it reach you in the, maybe
it
not
still
in the same
does,
way?
Actually, but I have to say, I'm still a sucker for it. I have a whole chapter in the book. I tried to grab my kids and take them on the old Lincoln Heritage Trail that I'd gone on with my father in the early 60s. There's quite a bit about, the reaction of a modern kid to those what were to me sacred places, and it's not quite as reverent as I would have felt when I was 11 and 12.
Well, the book is Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America by Andrew Ferguson. He's a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. Mr. Ferguson, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me.